Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, April the 8th. On this week's show, Kenny McCaskill, the SNP MP, will tell us why he defected to Alex Salmond's ALBA party. And the Prime Minister has promised freedom from lockdown after the 21st of June. But what kind of freedom will it be? All that to come in the next hour of Quality TV. And if you enjoy what we're doing here at Spectator TV, why not take out a subscription to the Spectator magazine itself? It's the fastest growing current affairs publication in Europe. And within its pages and on our website, you can read all your favorite Spectator TV contributors. We'll even throw in a bottle of free Spectator gin if you sign up at spectator.co.uk/TV offer. Or you can just Google Spectator Gin. That's a subscription of 12 issues for just £12, plus a free bottle of gin worth £30. Simple arithmetic. Arithmetic will tell you that's a no-brainer. And as ever, a very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of the Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted to be partners with them. Now, COVID. June the 21st is earmarked as Freedom Day on the roadmap out of lockdown. Even nightclubs are to reopen. Legal requirements on social distancing should go. And thanks to the UK's successful vaccine rollout, more than a semblance of pre-COVID normality beckons. Or does it? Is the government changing the goalposts already? Is June the 21st still our Freedom Day? And are serious hurdles to the continued rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca jab emerging, which could spook government ministers further? Kate Andrews is our economics correspondent, editor of our daily lunchtime briefing. It's the only roundup email you'll need for the latest COVID news. You can sign on via our website as she pens this week's cover pieces headlined Roadmap to Nowhere. Kate joins us now. Kate, what's happened? This June the 21st day is not as bankable for end of lockdown anymore, is it?
Sadly, no longer. When the Prime Minister laid out his roadmap, it very much seemed like the 21st of June was Freedom Day, the day that you'd be able to go back to a nightclub, go to a mass event, not have any cap on the numbers of people who could gather together. But in truth, they left the really difficult decisions for separate reviews around social distancing, international travel, returning to work, and potentially bringing in vaccine passports. And we got the teaser this week of their initial thinking in some of these areas. And the suggestion was, we don't know when social distancing may lift. Despite telling us for months that vaccine passports were off the table, Michael Gove said that he didn't know anybody in government, including himself, that was thinking about vaccine passports a few months ago. Now he's the one leading the charge to bring them in. It very much looks like they're on the cards. And if we don't have normal social distancing by the time we hit the summer, if we're having to use biosecurity guards, cards to access events, to access the pub, they haven't ruled hospitality out, by the way. I think a lot of people will say, well, that's not the normal that we thought we were promised. That is not the full return of our freedoms. It would seem that liberty is becoming conditional on doing very specific things that the government is asking you to do. And there was always a concern that when we signed them away to tackle the pandemic, to go into lockdown to save lives, that they wouldn't come rushing back. And despite the roadmap going ahead, and I'm sure many people are looking forward to being able to get a haircut or have a pint on the 12th of April, a lot of these major questions about how free we'll actually be are outstanding.
But it's interesting that this is happening in government when the rollout of the vaccine has gone better than they could ever have hoped back in January or even in February. And I see in your article, you say that both COVID cases and deaths are down 95% since the most recent peak, down 95%. And that's an even faster decline than in Israel, which has done even more vaccination than we have. Pretty much the whole population has now been covered there. And yet there is this almost stepping back from the original roadmap. And in your article, you say it's all because they've taken fright at the possibility of a mutant strain of the vaccine, of the virus, which the vaccine won't handle. Is that really what's at the bottom of this?
Fear of a new variant is very much on people's minds in Whitehall. Ministers are concerned and the travel task force is concerned. And we got their first update earlier this week about how we might resume international travel when it's legal again. It looks like we're going back to the traffic light system or the countries that you can visit this summer and for the foreseeable future without having to quarantine when you get back, either at home or in a hotel, will be countries depending on vaccination status, infection rates, and also whether or not officials think they are vulnerable to a new variant. Now, the idea of something new coming in and wiping out our vaccine progress is obviously terrifying. The difficulty in crafting public policy is that it's based on a hypothetical. So far, thankfully, we have not seen a variant that can undermine our vaccines, especially in those crucial areas of preventing hospitalization and death. So almost by nature, these rules and regulations are going to be indefinite because you're planning for something that might happen in the future, not necessarily based on the facts as they are now. So when we can travel again, it's certainly not going to be normal, and I don't think it's going to be for quite some time.
It's interesting that from the Prime Minister down, the emphasis from government is almost undermining their own strategy. The vaccine is not 100% effective. But as you point out, no vaccine is really 100% effective. And when it comes to deaths and even serious illness, this vaccine pretty much is 100% effective. Do they really know what they're doing?
So I think this is one of the most concerning areas, is that what we're told constantly seems to change. Matt Hancock told The Spectator magazine in January that he would be crying freedom once the most vulnerable were vaccinated. Grant Shapp said he would be on the barricades to restore our freedoms around a similar timeline. That hasn't happened. The Prime Minister said that we would be open by Easter because of the jab success at the end of last year. That hasn't happened. But now something even more worrying is happening. It's not just that they're pushing back this timeline. We're told, actually, vaccines aren't the full answer. And I do think that Boris Johnson and his officials sometimes come dangerously close to talking down these vaccines. As you say, Andrew, the fact that they're not 100% effective is really not the point. Nobody in their wildest dreams thought we would get a jab that had 100% efficacy. That Pfizer is thought to be around 94-95% effective, that AstraZeneca is very good, and that they're preventing against severe hospitalization and death is a huge success. It's a miracle, frankly, that we have multiple jabs that are as good as they are. And so if that isn't going to be what restores liberty, and now they're talking about the return of Operation Moonshot, which was estimated last year to be a £100 billion project. We're going to be doing mass testing on top of the vaccines, but perhaps even that isn't enough. We're going to have vaccine passports potentially. When does it end? And when can the public really see life being not just back to normal, but their decisions, their choices, their lifestyles being their own again, as opposed to what the state is saying they're allowed to do? It's this shift in power that liberty is now somehow conditional. And I think that's what the cover piece is trying to look at this week. Just how far down this rabbit hole do we want to go before we say enough is enough? And government needs to be transparent about criteria and deadlines and what they're actually trying to achieve.
You point out in the article how Michael Gove ruled out vaccine passports in December, that Matt Hancock, he came out against them in January, and that Mr. Zahawi, the vaccine minister, said there were no plans to do so. Where are we now with vaccine passports?
So these COVID certificates, as the Prime Minister likes to refer to them, but they're vaccine passports or bioidentity cards, are very much being considered. The official report that we got this week on the status of the review means that they are being considered for a whole host of areas, not just around mass events, but potentially to be in hospitality as well. We don't know the details about how they would work yet, although we do know that you wouldn't necessarily have to have your vaccine to have one. You could potentially have a negative COVID test or a test proving that you had COVID at some point within a certain matter of months to suggest that you also have antibodies. The idea here is that it wouldn't be fair to roll it out if some people had had the jab and others hadn't been offered it yet, especially because those people are young people at the moment, the under 50s who haven't been offered the jab. They are much less likely to die of this virus or get severely ill, and so there would be an imbalance there. But I think many will be asking, is it fair at all, number one, to have promised that this wasn't a consideration, and now to be very actively looking at how they might bring it in. And number two, it seems like a very short-term tactic to hand away that kind of liberty and personal data, especially when they're saying that vaccine passports wouldn't come online until the summer at least. They're not coming online for the 12th of April or on the 17th of May when indoor hospitality reopens and hopefully we can see more people inside. They're suggesting they'll come online when we're supposedly free. And I think the idea of flashing your vaccine passport to a private pub landlord or whoever to get into an establishment, there is even talk of face scanning in order to access things that we're told we're free to do, won't quite add up to people.
There's now talk of, when vaccine passports were first discussed, it was that you would have to have some documentation to show that you had been vaccinated, probably had both jabs. But now I see government talking, you've touched on it, of biosecurity cards, which seem to be a lot more than just a bit of paper or an app that says you've been vaccinated. Is the government seriously thinking of complicating things by going down this line?
So the Prime Minister was loath to call them anything but COVID status certification at the press conference on Monday. He didn't want to call them vaccine passports, certainly not biosecurity cards. And surely the reason is, or one of the reasons we can suspect, is because the Prime Minister spent his career adamantly opposed to such things. He once said that if he were asked to produce an identity card, he would rip it up and eat it in front of the state official that asked him to do so. If you get this week's copy of The Spectator, we have assembled quite a few quotes from the Prime Minister opposed to ID cards. So I imagine it's very difficult for him to be the person who now might be ushering them in to society. But we can't feel too bad for him because at the end of the day, he is the person in charge and he's the one who makes the calls. Now, maybe he's changed his mind. Maybe he thinks that they would be useful now. If so, it is not being communicated to the public. It is not at all transparent what data or ideas are backing up this idea. Because as you've mentioned throughout our chat here, Andrew, all of the data is pointing in a really positive direction. The percentage of people who have antibodies across the UK is now estimated to be over 50%, and it's just climbing because of our huge vaccine success. I think a lot of this can undermine trust if you're not honest with people about your real intentions. That NHS app that we were asked to download last year and sold on the premise that we would help track and trace people who had the virus in their contacts, but that information would be completely private, only you and you alone would see it. That app is now being talked about as this new mechanism for vaccine passports. Not only is the data not private, you're sharing it, but you're also with the venues and establishments you want to go into, but you're now uploading quite private health data into it. You know, that is a far cry from where we were just months ago. Now, I know a lot of people out there won't have my reservations. They'll be completely on board with something like this because they think it will be a good mechanism to help us get our freedoms back. But we need to have this very robust debate. At the moment, these decisions are being made by committee in reviews. This is, I think, a fundamental principle that could change the way we operate for months and potentially years to come. And we might start to see that debate. The Labour Party is, for the first time in this pandemic, really starting to push back, it seems, on this point alone. But, you know, we need to have this discussion. They may approve them in the end, they may not, but we need to be told exactly what their purpose is and why they think now, at this point of the pandemic, they're necessary. And then we can approve or criticize.
Let me bring in Jamie Njoku-Goodwin. He's the chief executive of UK Music. It's an umbrella organization representing the British music industry. Jamie, welcome to Spectator TV. What is your attitude towards vaccine passports? Would that help you reopen your businesses?
So for the past year, since March last year, it's been prohibited by law to have mass events at capacity. That's had a huge impact on our industry. And the challenge for us for the past 6 months or so has been, we can either put our heads under the sand and wait for this whole thing to go away, or we can look at different means and mechanisms by which we could be having events again via bin safely. So that's been looking at things like ventilation, better working guidance, testing, but also looking at things like certification. I think it's really important that we actually clarify what we're talking about here, because there's been a lot of cross purposes about this debate. Is this a vaccine passport to just prove that you've had a vaccine and are protected? Or is it about certifying and certification to show that you are at less risk of transmission? I'm really compelled by the argument for COVID status certification, not actually because of the fact it shows you to be protected, but because of the increase in evidence that vaccines can reduce transmission, and then in conjunction with a test, you can be using it to show that spaces are safer for social contact. We've had a year of lockdowns, and which are basically a blunt and crude object to stop social contact taking place in spaces, because government hasn't been able to identify who are the people who are at risk of transmission of this virus and who are the people that aren't. Actually, some sort of system where you can identify who is infectious, who might be passing this virus and who won't be, and therefore ensuring that rather than lockdowns, which mean a reduction of liberty for 60 million people, you can be restricting those restrictions to the people who are actually infectious. Seems to me to be good from a public health point of view, sensible for the large events and settings like nightclubs, music venues and mass events, which haven't been able to operate for the last year, but also importantly, would hopefully reduce the possibility that you get hit with a future wave in the future and have to lock down again at some point in the future.
Kate, what do you say to that?
Well, I think if we lived in a world where none of the vaccines had been successful, and the only way to get back to some kind of normality were through, say, mass testing, the idea of a COVID passport, a vaccine, not a vaccine passport in that circumstance, but some kind of passport to show your COVID status, as Jamie says, might be a pragmatic one. I think there's still many ethical issues with it. I'm not sure I would be able to support it, but I think the argument would be stronger. What's strange to me is that thankfully we don't live in that world. We live in a world where we have successful vaccines. The UK is still in the top 5 countries for rate of vaccination, and it's the country where the most number of adults want to take the vaccine. There really should be no reason, because these vaccines work, by the time we get to the summer, that we would be looking at bringing in something like a vaccine passport when the data is on our side and when the vaccines are on our side. And I worry about a short-termist look at freedom. You know, well, if we have this vaccine passport, we can get back to normal. And what we might be sacrificing in terms of the long-term. Once this framework comes in, this apparatus comes in, what will government use it for? They already haven't been honest about their plans to bring it in the first place. And we don't know who will be in power in 5-10 years' time. We don't know what the circumstances will be. If we create this now, under these emergency scenarios, even though we're really moving in the right direction, I fear what it means for future freedom, not just freedom this summer.
Yeah, so actually I view this as a long-term strategy rather than just a kind of short-termist one. This shouldn't be seen as something that's going to be brought in for good or permanently, but having this as a mechanism which can either be turned on or off depending on where you are in the pandemic state seems to me to be completely sensible. I completely agree with Kate that if we have a vaccine that is going to work permanently, isn't going to be affected by a new variant, then this wouldn't be necessary and we could just open up. But the worry seems to be, as with all other viruses, increased transmission increases the likelihood of a mutation, and you find yourself with a virus and a variant that is going to be virus resistant. This is what happens with flu. It's why every year you have to update your flu vaccines and develop new flu vaccines. And when you've got a virus that is as transmissible as COVID, increased transmission makes that much more likely. So I see this as a means and mechanism of trying to reduce transmission in a way that isn't, again, not doing it through lockdowns, not doing it through increased and sometimes quite draconian restrictions, but by doing it in a way where you can have normal life happening, but with certain mitigations, whether that's things like mask wearing, whether that's things like COVID certification. But I think it's also really important, not just for now, but for future pandemics. We're living in an age where, if you look at loss of biodiversity, increased international travel, what's happened with climate change, it's not going to be 100 years before we're hit by the next one of these things. It could be much sooner than we think. And a strategy in the future of, we're just going to lock down for a year, wait for a vaccine and then open up, personally, isn't good for industries, it's not good for individuals, and it's not good for anyone. If you can have some sort of system in place for the future, that means when you are hit by a future pandemic, you can have a testing system you can stand up, you can have a certification system that says rather than having to lock down your country for a year, you can identify who's infectious, who isn't, and probably try and have a much more normal life. I think if you had this sort of certification system this time last year, with a testing capacity and a certification system by which you could identify who was going to be at risk of spreading this virus, you'd have probably been able to go a long way without locking down bars, without locking down hospitality, without stopping mass events, and actually be able to be doing life as normal. So I view certification not just as something that's important for getting out of this pandemic, but also protecting and guarding against having to lock down in future ones as well.
So, Kate, what Jamie's arguing there is that a version of a biosecurity card, which is what this would almost certainly develop into, it would be a necessary tool for future, dealing with future pandemics. And if we have it, we might avoid the kind of lockdowns that we've had to endure in this pandemic.
Well, I'm not just sure he's arguing for a biosecurity card, but a biosecurity state. I mean, the world that Jamie just painted is one in which liberty is never fully restored. It turns out that our lifestyle before was too carefree, too loose, that we are always going to need to think about the next hypothetical thing that can go wrong. And we need to make sure that people are ready to get in line to do whatever the government asks them to do in order to tackle that hypothetical. If you have this certification system, as Jamie says, and something else comes along, whatever it may be, what's going to be the new certification? What is it this time that the state's going to ask you to do so that you can go to the pub, so that you can go to a mass event, so that you can be free? We don't know what that future is imagined to be, but let's hope that when it comes, we will have proper scrutiny and debate, and that people will have some say and get to decide what they think the right level of risk is. If we set up a system in which our freedoms are always conditional on what the state has decided is the appropriate level of risk, we are never going back to the way it was. Now, I think you can make that argument. In fact, this is exactly the debate that I think needs to happen over the next few weeks and months. Do we want to trade away all of that liberty for security? And you know, plenty of people will, and I think that there's an argument to make, but let's be very honest about what that future actually looks like. And let's not call it normal. Let's not even call it the new normal. It would be the introduction of a biosecurity state in which it wouldn't matter if the evidence was on the government side. It would only have to be a hypothetical. It used to be the case that if politicians wanted to infringe on your freedom, they had to present that argument, they had to make the case, and they had to convince hearts and minds. But now we're saying that that power is flipped. We'll only return it when you can prove that it's safe enough to return it, that you can prove that things won't go wrong. And I think that is the wrong place to put the power. I think that we need to flip that back. Because otherwise, as said, we don't know what the future looks like in 10 years' time. We don't know who's in charge. We don't know how they'll want to use this. So to bring it in these circumstances, I think could in the future go badly wrong.
Jamie, final word to you. I think a lot of people may conclude that what you're arguing for is really ID cards by the back door, but actually a lot more intrusive than ID cards because they'll contain a lot more information than Tony Blair, when he was arguing for ID cards, ever envisaged. It would be ID cards on steroids.
So, I mean, I'd firstly say I completely agree with Kate. This is a debate that actually needs to be had, a discussion that needs to be had quite openly. There's a lot of ethical and legal and regulatory issues that people need to be talking about and having an actual debate on. Look, for the past year, maybe I like the pub too much, maybe I like bars too much, but I haven't been sat there thinking, that stuff is closed, but at least I don't have to show my COVID certification status. We're living in a pandemic where difficult decisions are having to be taken, but the focus is having to be, what can you be doing to be able to make sure things are safe and not at risk of increased variants and of future waves? I don't see this as a biosecurity state. We're currently living through a world where the government is doing 1.5 million tests a day. Now, make sure you can be using that testing, those testing results, and using that testing capacity in a way that can identify how people can be kept as safe as possible. Again, I don't see that as a biosecurity state. All this sort of stuff is already happening. It's making sure that the work that's being done is being utilised as effectively as possible to prevent the threat of future waves, but also to return some of the liberties I think lots of us have missed over the past year. But I completely agree with Kate. It's a debate that I think lots we should be having, and that I think Kate puts her argument forward very, very well.
Well, it's a debate we've had here in Spectator TV, and we'll come back to it. Jamie Onjuko Godwin, Chief Executive of UK Music, thanks for being with us today. And Kate Andrews of The Spectator, thank you as well. Now, remember, if you enjoy what we do here at Spectator TV, why not take out a subscription to The Spectator magazine itself? Just Google Spectator Gin to subscribe for £1 a week and a free bottle of Spectator Gin with it. What's not to like about that? Now, some argue that the evidence of Britain's irredeemably racist past can be found in our historical statutes. The Rhodes Statue in Oxford, for example, has been under the spotlight for some time now. It's still there so far. But slave owner Edward Colston was toppled at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests in Bristol last summer. The government's response has been a so-called retain and explain policy. In other words, wax and plaques on controversial statues to educate the passerby, but keep the monuments in place. Sounds a compromise? Sounds good? Well, Spectator contributor Alexander Pelling-Bruce argues against it in this week's issue. He joins Spectator TV now. Alexander, welcome to the program. Thank you for your article in The Spectator this week. Let me start with the intriguing example. I think so far you say the only example of retain and explain in action in the United Kingdom, which is in Edinburgh. It involves Henry Dundas, a very famous historical Scottish figure who became Lord Melville. And because, although as I understand it, he had managed to establish that under Scottish law, slavery would be illegal, he inserted in the legislation to abolish slavery the word gradual. And for that, there has to be an explanatory plaque on the statue. Have I got it right? Tell us what happened in Edinburgh.
Yes, that is essentially right. So the contention is that he inserted this word gradual, and the anti-Dundas activists say that therefore this delayed abolition and therefore resulted in the transportation and death of 500,000 slaves, which otherwise would not have happened. This, I think, is a gross distortion because, first of all, it's attributing causation, direct causation, where I think that is not applicable. But also, on the historical fact of it, is that by inserting that word, a good interpretation is that he actually ensured the passage of the Act, because otherwise, for the anti-abolitionist movement, not having that word would be too strong.
But it was interesting that you point out that Edinburgh City Council did not bring in respected historians to decide what, if anything, should be on a plaque explaining more about Henry Dundas. That they instead used somebody called Jeff Palmer, who is basically, he's got, I think, previous record of being pretty anti-Dundas and is also a human rights activist. He's not, as I understand it, a historian of this period that would bring expertise to the issue. Is that right?
That is exactly right. And he's been on the anti-Dundas hunt, you know, for many years, actually. This whole debate over Dundas and the Melville Monument goes back a number of years now. And initially, Edinburgh City Council proposed, a proper commission made up of balanced views and different historians to examine this issue. What happened was they didn't come to a settled conclusion, and so the matter was sort of parked. Then you had the Black Lives Matter protests last year, and within 3 days after that, they'd hastily assembled a new commission with Jeff Palmer. They got rid of the other historians that they had before, and then they quickly settled on this wording. So there was no proper process, there was no diligence, there was no establishing, you know, the total facts in this and coming to a kind of settled view that would be academically respectable. This is also, you can see this, for example, with other commissions that have been set up, most notably Sadiq Khan's London Diversity in the Public Realm Commission. The makeup of it is populated by these sort of race relations activists and people who have already actually expressed a view on these matters before the inquiry actually takes place. It also happened with the Rhodes Commission in Oxford, where there was not enough sort of historical weight and expertise of this.
What should be done though, with someone, say, take the Colson statue, which was brought down and dumped in the harbour by kind of mob action. But we're talking here about a man who, as I understand it, was regarded at the time in Bristol as something of a philanthropist, but had undoubtedly made his money out of slavery and had, I think, been a slave owner or trader, and that's where his money came from. The fact that he became a philanthropist is nevertheless surely clouded by where the money comes from. I mean, if I was part of the Brinks Mat robbery and then used some of that to be a philanthropist, it would surely rather tarnish my reputation as a philanthropist. What should be done with a statue like that?
Well, remember the old saying from Emperor Trajan, pecunia non olet, when he used public funds to set up sewers, I think, in Rome. Money doesn't stink. I'm not sure that the money, the provenance of the money, actually is the overriding factor in these things. I think it's what the money is used for. As by way of comparison, you see this with museums when they are sponsored by sort of petrochemical companies like BP and whatever. The money is still being used to a good cause. It's a question in that context. It's a question of, are there sort of quid pro quos? Are there is that company benefiting in sort of a way that's not in the public interest? In the Colston case, we have a plane flying overhead. I hope.
I heard that, but carry on. Struggle through.
In the Colston case, of course, he was a great benefactor to the city, and that is why the statue was raised by public subscription in Bristol. So the point I'm trying to make here is, if we are going to get into if we're going to establish this premise that any supposed moral flaw or wrongdoing, for example, David Olusoga, who I think is actually one of the more serious decolonizing historians, he said in an interview of Channel 4 with Jon Snow, I don't think we should be having memorials and statues that legitimize and validate the lives of people who've done terrible things. I think it's inappropriate. Well, that's a rather sort of banal, schoolmasterly way of putting it, I think. And the problem here is, these statues are not established as testaments of character. If that were the case, we would have statues, to volunteers, to civil servants, perhaps, to saints and priests, or maybe not all priests, but anyway, they are there because that individual has done some public good, or is being recognised for a particular set of public achievements. So this whole retain and explain approach completely transforms the purpose of a statue, and I think that in itself is why it might be misguided.
All right, Alexander Pelling Bruce, it's a fascinating article. So we'll see how far the government gets with its retain and explain policy, and also see what kind of rules it may put round that to deal with what happened to Henry Dundas in Edinburgh. Thanks for the article. Thanks for joining us on Spectator TV. Now, the weeks are counting down to May's Holyrood elections in Scotland, and a surprise electoral force a couple of weeks ago joined the fray. Alex Salmond has established his own party, called it ALBA. That's not quite the correct pronunciation. And he's been taking SNP defectors from the first day. So what's his purpose? What does it hope to achieve? Let's speak to one of those defectors, Kenny McCaskill. He was the SNP MP for East Lothian, and he joins us now. Welcome to Spectator TV, Kenny McCaskill.
Thank you. I was enjoying the discussion on Dundas.
It was very interesting, I agree. The author also mentions the Hunterian Museum in at the University of Glasgow, which is one of the finest university museums in the United Kingdom. It now has what's called a curator of discomfort. I'm not quite sure what that is, but it's got one. But I didn't get on to that. Anyway, back to you and the elections. Why have you left a party which was led by the most popular politician in Scotland to join one whose leader, Alex Salmond, is as unpopular in Scotland as Boris Johnson?
Well, I think this is the necessary opportunity. It's necessary because the threat we are facing in terms of what happens post-pandemic, in terms of increased austerity, and there's the opportunity there by an independent supermajority. So fundamentally, it's about delivering an independent supermajority within the Scottish Parliament. But equally, it'd be fair to say that there had been issues within the SNP. So I depart in reasonable terms because I had many more good years and still agree with much. But there were issues that took me to go. But fundamentally, fundamentally, it's about what we can do. And I think what we can say is that we've already changed what was meant to be a rather sleepy election, where independence was just simply going to be rhetorical. And it was a question of would the SNP get a majority and who would come second, with independence now being front and centre of the debate.
If you get this supermajority, you want a fast-track referendum. Is that right? How quickly would you want a second referendum?
No, what we're saying is it changes, first of all, the whole nature of the debate. I know the SNP position is the thought that Johnson would blink. We don't necessarily adhere to that. This view that he'll change his position on the Section 30 order as technology is. I think what we're seeking to do is to ensure that after the 6th of May, it's not a Scottish government asking a Westminster Prime Minister. It's in fact the Scottish Parliament representing Scottish democracy that is demanding the right for self-determination. That could be a referendum if they're prepared to accede to it. There are other ways it can be looked at in terms of court actions, international steps, and indeed just public representation, whether in demonstrations as and when that's allowed.
But how quickly, if you get this supermajority, how quickly would you like the referendum?
Well, we want to move towards Scotland getting the necessary powers as soon as possible. Whether that's by way of a referendum, that will have to be discussed, because so far that's not an option being allowed. And therefore,
what other way could Scotland get independence other than a referendum?
Well, you can have negotiations between the parliaments. Ultimately, you're correct. Almost invariably, they have to be put to the people in a referendum. That happens. It's happened in Slovakia. It happened in Ireland over a century ago. But you could have the discussions about where you're going rather than having a vote on the concept initially. So there's a whole array of opportunities that we'd have to come about. But if the Scottish Parliament is representing the democratic will of the Scottish people, which is for independence, then I think that changes the whole dynamic, the same as ALBA has changed the dynamic of the electoral debate.
But the Scottish people on May are not electing a parliament for independence. They're electing a parliament to run their schools and their hospitals and their transport. If you look at opinion polling, a second referendum comes way down the list compared to hospitals and schools.
The Scottish people have been denied a second referendum because Boris Johnson's made it clear that he's not prepared to do it. The Scottish National Party and indeed the Parliament have voted for a referendum and have supported that, and yet it's been rejected. In that circumstance, we see it as perfectly legitimate to use the Holyrood elections as the means of giving our people a form of plebiscite. And that's why on the list vote, they can vote for ALBA, which is a vote for an independent supermajority. They're under no doubt what they're looking for, exactly the same as George Galloway is putting forward a party. So as I say, I think in the denial of democracy by a refusal of a Section 30 order, we've opened up the requirement to use the Holyrood elections as a plan B, as some of my colleagues used to talk about.
But back in 2017, just after the general election, and the SNP fought that general election on a second referendum, you wrote that there was, quote, no credible platform on which to win another referendum, and that people were tired of referenda. That was only 4 years ago. What's changed?
Well, I think one of the reasons I've gone to ALBA is that there has been a lack of preparation amongst the leadership of the SNP. Action does have to be taken on discussing borders and discussing currency and discussing pensions, issues that we knew were difficult in 2014, issues that have now transformed because of Brexit. So the groundwork has to be laid. ALBA will be doing that and the Parliament can ensure that. So that was a position taken with regard to the SNP. And equally, it would also be fair to say that the Brexit deal that has been struck is causing mayhem in the economy in Scotland, in my own constituency in particular. The threats to our health and social services faced by trade deals that are coming down the line with the USA, the attacks upon our Parliament through the Internal Market Bill, all of these things mean that the ground has changed and now is the time for Scotland to defend itself.
All right, well, 4 years ago that you wrote that doubts on the currency and on pensions, as two examples, have not been answered or assuaged. So in 4 years, do you now have the answer? What currency would an independent Scotland use?
Well, we're making it clear that we'll move towards our own currency. Initially, we have to use sterling. That is perfectly possible. Governor Mark Carney acknowledged that before he retired. There won't be a currency union. That was the position taken by George Osborne, but there can be use of sterling. But we'll move as soon as we can towards a Scottish currency. That's perfectly.
So you would use a form of sterlingisation, as it's called.
You
wouldn't be part of monetary union, but you would still use sterling, which you would have no right to print or to set interest rates, and you wouldn't have a central bank as a bank of last resort because it wouldn't be able to create money. How long would you be in that position?
Well, I'd be for as short as period of time as is possible. That's something that has to be discussed both within our party democracy and fundamentally by those negotiating. But I think, you know, there was a plan put forward by the Scottish National Party through the Growth Commission that was for some considerable period of time. That is unacceptable. It has to be in a reasonable time scale. It has to be quite speedy. But the precise term, I don't think, will be for me. It will be for those representing the Scottish Government and speaking on behalf of the Scottish Parliament. But it'll have to be speedier.
And do you accept that if there was a new currency to be launched, that you would have to pay in your interest rates a risk premium, because this would be a new currency with no track record for a country with a massive budget deficit and a balance of payments deficit? You'd have to pay a lot to borrow, wouldn't you?
Well, these things have been changing and evolving. There are issues and challenges that we face exactly the same as those issues and challenges that the United Kingdom faces. But the resources Scotland faces, the position in which we are in terms of being able to transition on to independence, we're in a better position than almost any country in the history of being able to move out.
So there are challenges, but the upside
you would move
is
out
the challenge
with a
15, of your own destiny.
You would move out with a deficit. About 10% of GDP. It would be the highest deficit in Europe. You're proposing a new currency that you'd have to borrow in to finance some of that deficit. I doubt you could finance it all. So you would be paying a lot of money to borrow to get people to lend for that huge deficit. That's not a very good position to be in.
Well, almost every government has been operating on a deficit other than Japan and China for many years, so it's nothing unusual. And indeed, as I say, I think the whole nature of the economy that we were told was impossible of deficit. You know, the whole coronavirus crisis across the world, not simply the Western world, has shown that deficits are necessary, can be managed. It's how you deal with your economy. At the present moment, the Scottish economy is being damaged by the Brexit deal.
Yours would be the biggest in Europe. What currency would people's pensions be paid in?
Well, these things are arrangements that are made. They happen, you know, across borders. You're speaking to me from out with, you know, the United Kingdom, so it's nothing unusual for people to be receiving pensions, payments, or whatever else in different countries and different currencies.
But
these are matters that have to be arranged.
My pension's paid in sterling, which is what I always expected it to be. But what currency would an independent Scotland's pensions be in?
Well, independent Scotland, once you moved into the Scottish currency, they would be in the Scottish currency. It would be depending where you're getting your pension. I will be receiving a pension presumably from Westminster unless arrangements are made with the Scottish Parliament, and I'll also be receiving a pension through the Scottish Civil Service. So these things are dealt with by the individual institution depending upon their...
Well, I would suggest if you have your own currency, you could only pay pensions in whatever that Scottish currency was, and there would always be a risk, which I think it would only be fair to make knowledgeable to the Scottish people, that as a new currency, as the new kid on the block, there would be a risk that that currency could depreciate substantially against sterling, wouldn't there?
Well, there are risks in every currency, as we've seen with the pound sterling, which has gone up and gone down or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day...
Yeah, but that doesn't matter for pensions, Kenny McCaskill. You know, it may go up or down, but you're paying for stuff in sterling and your pension's in sterling. You would be in a situation where you would be paying pensions in local currency, and against sterling, it could be substantially devalued.
But the problem with the Scottish economy at the present moment is we don't have the levers of power. Our economy is underperforming. You know, I grew up in the 60s, at a time when oil was discovered in Scotland and in Norway. Scotland has been left lagging way behind as Norway has motored on. The economy of the Republic of Ireland has motored beyond not simply Northern Ireland, but Scotland, with a higher quality of life and standard of living. That's because these countries have been able to decide their own future, to take decisions, to benefit from their own natural assets. And so, yes, of course, you're correct. There are issues and challenges that we face. But equally, there are opportunities, because the tragedy for Scotland, Andrew, isn't how bad things are for the likes of me, because life's quite good for me, I have to say. But tragically, it's not good for so many more. Scotland should be doing so much better. We are underperforming. That's ultimately the responsibility of Westminster, that has been in charge of the economic levers of power.
Why are you so vituperative about Nicola Sturgeon? In July 2020, you described her as a narcissistic sociopath.
No, I didn't.
In July 2020, you were criticized for liking, you were liking a tweet. Sorry, I corrected, but you liked a tweet calling her a narcissistic sociopath.
Well, that was a friend who had put the tweet out. It wasn't my words, and I was simply it was in relationship to the person I knew.
So you like things you don't like?
Well, I think we all retweet things, and, you know, social media has a downside. I'm currently getting a lot of traffic in, as you can imagine, and we come with that. I've stood shoulder to shoulder with Nicola Sturgeon and with Alex Salmond. I stood on the platform with them together on referendum. I disagree with actions that Nicola has taken, but equally I respect the contribution she has made when I served in Cabinet with her, and indeed her continued contribution in the Scottish Government. But we disagree on various issues, and on that basis I have gone into the ALBA party.
You accused her of treating voters with contempt.
I don't know the context that you're referring to that. I mean, I may have used those words, but I think you would require to tell me just what the context of the article was, because it'll be one reference to something.
Right, well, it was a reference to a number of things that she had been doing. You accused her of the SNP had become, under her, a Stalinist, strict Presbyterian sect.
Well, I think there are issues, and that's why I've chosen
to... It's the vituperation of the language. I mean, political disagreement I can understand, but this is a woman who has become, you know, the best-known politician in Scotland, the most formidable politician in Scotland, who leads a government that is almost certainly to be re-elected in May in some form. And yet your language about her is, it's almost as if you were... talking in your language about the Tories.
Well, I think if you will recall that I was out of politics for a while. I was a columnist, as you yourself are and as your colleagues are in the Spectator. You use language that you wouldn't necessarily perhaps use when you're an elected politician to describe things. I, as I say, have the highest respect for Nicola Sturgeon. I disagree with her on how she has been running the operation of the Scottish National Party. It's simply unacceptable that her husband is the chief executive. I've argued that even, you know, when I was still an MSP. I think there are issues in where they've gone and women's rights that I fundamentally disagree with, and I've written about in the paper today, because I think there are issues, whether it's in unisex toilets or the safety and security of staff and women prisoners in the women's prison estate, that the SNP has made big mistakes on. But I recognise her commitment to independence, I recognise her contribution, and that's why both Alex Salmond, myself and every member of ALBA will be happy to stand shoulder to shoulder with her and every other member of the SNP on the wider common cause.
If there is not a majority of MSPs after the election who stood on an independence manifesto, if there's not a majority, what then happens to a second referendum?
Well, it's exactly the same. There is a majority. It depends upon the present moment. Until the SNP are prepared to change their position, then we're dependent upon Boris Johnson's veto. We think that delivering an independence majority changes the whole dynamic of the debate and opens up...
I understand that, and that's almost the raison d'etre of ALBA. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But if there isn't a majority of MSPs for independence after May, what happens to a second referendum?
Well, I believe that there will be, but the position of ALBA, and indeed the position I always subscribed to in the SNP, Andrew, was that I want independence, but also, as well as independence, I want Scotland to be the best it can be. So whilst you're in devolution, then you have to make sure that the Scotland that you seek is as good as it can be. And indeed, if the people of Scotland were ever to decide that they ultimately didn't want independence, then it would still be my obligation in my home country to make sure that this is the best country that it can be. There are issues, you know, that we have to address in Scotland, not all of which I fully accept can be laid at the bare of London. We have to up our game across a whole swathe of areas. But the only people who are going to do that, the only people who will prioritise that, are the Scots and through their elected representatives.
The turnout at Scottish elections is not that impressive. If it was under 50%, if turnout was below 50% in May, where would that leave your mandate?
Well, I think the mandate would still exist, because you take elections on terms of what is delivered and it's the outcome. There are challenges in this election, which is why, you know, postal ballots are increasingly being pushed.
But even if half the Scots hadn't voted, that would surely undermine your mandate, even if you were to win a supermajority?
Well, I'm not going to deny I want as big a turnout as possible, and equally fair to say that I think those in the more challenged areas where voting is perhaps less the norm are also more likely to vote for us. So there's an imperative for us to actually try and ensure that, and we will be doing that, because I think what was clear was that in the independence referendum, the turnout was higher in that referendum than it has been in any Holyrood election before or after. That tends to be the situation in referenda that do encourage huge turnouts and wider issues. So I think the turnout here will be substantial, will be significant, because we've made this on the constitution.
Just a final question. Ian Blackford, who leads the SNP parliamentary delegation in Westminster in the House of Commons, he said of your defection that you'd become an increasing embarrassment to the SNP, and that your departure was somewhat of a relief. As people who are united by a common cause, that doesn't sound like solidarity to me.
Well, I think that's what Ian Blackford to comment on. He made similar curtic and caustic remarks against Joanna Cherry, who remains in the SNP. I think that's something Ian Blackford should reflect upon. I'm not going to criticise him on air. I've disagreed with him on issues, but equally, again, as with Nicola Sturgeon, on the cause of independence, I will continue to work with him as I always have in the past. I just hope that he will reflect and learn from that.
Kenny McCaskill, I know election campaigns are a busy time, so we're grateful to you for giving us your time here on Spectator TV.
Thank you.
Now, that's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests and to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley. The sponsor of the Week in 30 Minutes is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, Charles Stanley, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. Finally, a reminder to pick up that bottle of Spectator gin. It's worth £30, but it's free to you if you sign up to subscribe to The Spectator at spectator.co.uk/TV offer. Or if you want to make it simple, just Google Spectator Gin and you'll find your way to a subscription and the gin. As always, send any thoughts you have to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk and join us again next week. Bye-bye.